Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young. My guest on the podcast this week is Frank Wander. Frank is a former turnaround CIO, author and founder of People Productive, a next generation human capital management company. Frank helps HR organizations and their business partners tap vast pools of dormant talent potential so the people side of their businesses can move faster than the rapidly changing business environment itself. By increasing the velocity of work, his clients unlock stronger business results. Frank helps focus teams around productivity and get the best out of people through productive culture. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Alex. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you here. And you've got a very unique background and specialize in an area of business, which sometimes is perhaps a little bit overlooked by some organizations. But rather than me sort of telling everyone exactly what you've done and all the amazing work that you've been doing in the space that you're in at the moment, it'd be great to hand over to you just for you to run through all the awesome stuff that you've done.
Well, sure. You know, it's interesting. Everybody's on a journey. You never know quite where it's going to go. I was a bio major in college and really had no idea what I was going to do. Interviewed with some companies, ended up getting a job as a programmer trainee, had a real aptitude for it, quickly moved into management. And I got into doing projects and, you know, I was good at it. I could get things done. And certainly in IT over the years, if you could get things done, there was always plenty of things not getting done that needed to be fixed. And I got moved in to turn around, you know, really projects that just weren't working, fix them, get them working. I eventually became a turnaround CIO. And, you know, I was grateful. IT was always a fabulous career because you're working on creating things that worked. You know, if you're programming, it talked back to you. It was just fabulous. And technology, of course, blossomed and boomed. And along the way on that journey, I had an epiphany because I went to a company to do a turnaround and I walked in and the place was just completely broken. And it wasn't just that the technology was broken. They couldn't get things done. That was always the case. But what I realized, because I was coming from another place, was a pattern. And the pattern was that all the technology was broken because the human infrastructure was completely broken and disconnected. And, you know, I realized that what gets produced in an organization is a reflection of the social system that produced it. If the social system and that fabric is frayed, everything they produce is broken, nothing works. And because I was a bio major, I realized this, because this is, you know, it's an unseen world, you know, human emotion, human capabilities and talents, you know, you can't see them directly. You could see a smile. You can't really see what's going on inside the person. You don't know that emotional state of that individual. Most of it is an unseen world. And I said, this is the root cause of failure in technology organizations and companies. People don't know how to use the human infrastructure. And I spent a lot of time, because I like doing research, saying, how could this be that, you know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars of projects failing every year? It was always getting written up. And the fundamental root cause was the inability of leaders to create essentially great cohesive work environments where they could tap the full potential of their people. And as I dug into it, I realized that the history of humanity was that, you know, at one time we had really craftsmen for hundreds of years, thousands of years who were craftsmen who had a lot of self-esteem. They had a lot of pride. They built great deep expertise. And when the industrial era came along, we turned all of these incredible craftsmen into just interchangeable parts. It was a complete dehumanization of humanity. And I think we're in an era where, you know, we're trying to get our humanity back. You know, it's happening all the time. I call it the rehumanization of work. It is happening. And leaders are going to have to become human performance engineers. They're going to have to understand the talent, the people they've been given, as deeply as they understand all the tools, technology, and other things that they're given to work on. And humans remain fascinated with this physical stuff, with tools and technology, and less fascinated about humans and human possibilities. And I think it's all about unlocking human possibilities. And that's really where we've ended up. And we're in an era where this is the talent era. I've given a lot of talks on it. There is no question about it. In this talent era, the companies that win will be the ones where the people and the company flourish together. And there are many examples of those companies out there. We could talk about them later, but it's been going on for a long time. This rehumanization of work is happening. I see a lot of things out there, you know, the DEI movement to create inclusive environments. I believe, you know, to become more human is a very good thing because then people are really capable of giving their best. Google did a study on what turned out to really be psychological safety, found out that was the number one contributor to work, which means people are really comfortable in their environment. They feel connected to everyone. They can speak up. They can contribute fully. These things are all true. And at the end of the day, people are the most important tool in every company. Leaders must be the human performance engineers who can coach, grow, nurture people to give their best. I mean, that's where we've ended up. And that's my journey. I ended up here serendipitously. You know, I was a bio major who happened to get into an environment and uncovered or just saw one day through this epiphany that everybody knew everything, but they didn't care about the people. I made it my business to learn about the human side of IT, which is in fact now the human side of business.
And it's a topic that I'm absolutely obsessed about. And particularly with your background, which is not too dissimilar mm-hmm. to mine, coming from quite a scientific origin and then going into technology. And whenever I talk about leadership or communication skills or you know, emotional intelligence, often that is sort of directed around the sort of C-suite or managers and things like that. But specifically mm-hmm. for things like IT and in sort of fast-growing technology companies were often, certainly at the very early stage, a lot of companies you know fail and die because they can't hit deadlines or they can't update their product quickly Correct. Enough compared to their competitors or their markets. From your experiences of you know coming into companies that are struggling and turning them around, what are some of the major kind of failures there on the human side that they're actually really impacting the day-to-day of that productivity in IT?
Well, you know, you can look at just so many things. You know, when you look at an IT organization, it's not about individuals creating things. An individual artist can create a great painting. But in IT, when you produce a work, it could be the work of 100 people, each one putting certain brushstrokes on that painting. And you've got to create a great piece of art. And in order to do that, you've got to have real open lines of communication. There has to be a high degree of teamwork and relationships. And if that doesn't exist, then all the communication that needs to take place, all the ideas that need to be shared so they can zero on what's really innovative, the ability to focus in on building great user experiences and things, which in its own right is a skill, the ability to go higher for those aptitudes, to integrate those aptitudes in, because it is a product of actually mind and emotion. That's what you're really dealing with. The emotion is driving that creativity. You know, certain people are very creative because they've been gifted with different aptitudes. And you've got to take people with a set of different aptitudes and you've got to literally weave them together and create an environment where the weave becomes tight and cohesive so that, in fact, they can really become this highly innovative, creative group working with the right aptitudes to really produce great outcomes for the company. And what I see is that the leaders don't know how to do that. You know, they were taught to think. Everybody went to school. They were taught to think. Actually, in school was the worst because they were taught to be an individual that excelled individual that did well on a test because they studied more and studied harder. And they would get the grade and they get rewarded for doing something individualistic and parroting things back, not creating anything, certainly not doing group creativity. I know education's changing, but education taught people to think, not to feel. And now we strive to find that human emotion that's in everybody, to tap it and to really unlock the best people have to give by creating environments where that social fabric that drives productivity is tight. It's a tapestry and it's got to come together. And this is why things fail. They can't weave that tapestry.
And from your experiences, when you've gone into some of these environments, which, you know, where that sort of, you know, the tapestry isn't weaved together, or there isn't that emphasis on human performance and communication through engineering teams and through senior leadership teams, what are some of the first things that you go and attack as someone who's coming in from the outside to sort of sort that situation out? Are there any kind of commonalities across all those companies where you can come in and do a certain set of things which will improve it, or is it quite variable, do you think?
Well, you know, when you come in, there are a set of things you have to do, right? So first thing when you're coming into a turnaround situation is you've got to stabilize the environment. And generally, you know, that involves both all the business processes. It does involve technology and involves people. And, you know, if you have a lot of turnover, which is generally what's going on in these environments, you've got to create an environment that people want to stay. You've got to keep the talent. The talent is everything. And you find that the talent itself in these environments, they're demotivated. They're very low energy affairs. You can see, you know, on the faces of the people, the kind of the negative energy that they're picking up from the environment. You've also got to understand what went wrong, because it is a business. And, you know, over my career, I was doing this certainly years ago, and they didn't want to hear about the human side of business. People are much more likely to want to hear about it now. Matter of fact, they're looking for CIOs and leaders today that get the human side and can build a great culture. That was never the case years ago. I remember one HR guy saying, hey, that's very important, but don't lead with that. You know, and to me, it was everything. So I would focus on all the traditional stuff. We would do all the strategies. We'd do all the plans. We'd have a whole infrastructure strategy. But I would have all strategy to build a great culture. And I would work on these things at the same time. And, you know, when you come in to do a turnaround, you're building credibility, right? They've been through failure. It's not as if they trust you out of the box because they liked you on the interview. They're looking for you to make a difference. So you've got to get some early wins. You've got to stabilize the environment. Whatever's been in the way, you've got to start delivering things. And then you use that platform where people are working well together. I remember I went into one place, large place, you know, over 1,000 people. They had 17% turnover. That following year, I got it down to 4%. And the year after that, I got it down to 2%. And that was because I cared about people. We had a real mission. I made it a little exciting. You know, you've got to be able to manage organizational energy, that passion and mood. That's a tool. You've got to get a feel for that. You've got to understand how it is. You've got to break down these walls and silos. People tend not to collaborate that well across organizational boundaries. And you've got to get from me to we in the organization. And you've got to get leaders who start to care about people. You got to get rid of all the toxic people. And, you know, there's science to all of this. When I went into a place, I was always fortunate because, you know, the person I was replacing was generally very toxic. So if you look at the work of Paul Ekman, what you find is he discovered that fear gets imprinted in the limbic system. So if you saw a lion in the woods and it chased you, you would have imprinted in your brain that picture of that lion. And if you saw it from a distance, your limbic system would go off and you'd get ready for flight or fright. That happens in the workplace. If you've threatened, diminished, you know, or done things that really set off the limbic system as a leader, you're a toxic leader, but you're a threat. And Paul Ekman showed that fear imprinting is real. All you need is for that person, that toxic leader, to walk into a room, to pass the person in the hallway. You'll set off a limbic event. And actually, when the limbic system engages, there's no creative thought. There's really no problem solving. 100% of the focus of that talented person is on survival. You know, the body gears everything to survival. It diverts more blood flow to things that would be geared towards survival. So, you know, you're really dealing with organizations where you have toxic leaders that are producing survival level output from people. Right? That's what it is. And, you know, you've got to create an environment that's caring. We know humans are wired for caring. They've done all the infant cognition experiments. Yale University's Infant Cognition Center, they showed that little babies as young as 4 months old gravitate towards these nice puppets versus these mean puppets. You know, the one experiment, you know, where they had the babies couldn't talk 4 months old. They would have a bad puppet like Slam, something down, a box lid on another puppet, and they had a good and a bad puppet, and the babies would look at the bad puppet for 4 seconds, but they'd spend 30 or 35 seconds looking at the good puppet. So toxic leaders cannot really build followership. They're not trusted. In many cases, they're hated. People are leaving them. We're in this great resignation now. People wonder why. The fact of the matter is they never learned to care about the people. Caring is a real thing. It is a gateway to everything. And that is science as well. I mean, all of this is science. All these studies are out there. Like people say, lead by example. Guess what? Albert Bandura did social learning theory. Fact of the matter is people don't do what you say. They do what you do. It's science. So this is leadership. You want to do human performance engineering. You know, you don't have to understand all the scientific experiments, but you've got to know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. You don't have to be a PhD. You have to be more human-centric. You have to be more oriented towards humanity and start thinking about yourself as kind of the coach who's going to nurture and grow them. I always liken culture to soil. And I think you've got to build a great soil and you've got to acquire the right seed, which is how do you go out and acquire talent with the skills, aptitudes, and competencies you need to be successful? Because if you don't have that, I don't care how good the soil is, right? The front end of this, you got to get it right. Then you've got to get those seeds to germinate. You got to nurture and grow them because, you know, they're living things. You've got to create a bumper crop. That's your job. So it's all science.
You touched on, you know, Alex. Oh, 100%. I'm here with you for science in this, and it's you know, it's something that I'm so passionate about in terms of building a company culture where you've got elements of data that are showing that it's effective, and looking at kind of, you know, the human centric behavior change when that's being introduced through learning and training and things like that. And one of the things you mentioned there was coaching. If you are, you know, let's say we've got some people listening to this podcast who might be in positions of leadership, or they might be employees who've been at a company for a while and they've noticed that the company culture where they are isn't particularly good. What are some of the things that they can do in terms of either coaching their team or, you know, highlighting and flagging up things that need to change to improve that company productivity?
Yeah. So, you know, everybody can always contribute at the level they're at. Now, if you're an individual contributor, you can't do much to change your culture, to be honest with you. The leadership sets the culture. That is a reflection of who they are. So if you're in a bad culture, if you've got leaders who are building a bad culture, and unless that changes, you're not going to be in a great culture. But if you're in an area of a company where there is a great leader with a great culture and you happen to deal with some open sewer pipes coming from other parts of the company, you know, you can create a great culture in that environment as long as those leaders in that area get it. They care about the people. They understand that people need to be grown. Companies have stopped investing in talent. You know, they stopped all the training and the growth because they said they're going to leave anyway. Well, you know, what if they don't? What if you keep them? You know, you've got to have that attitude that we can hang on to the people and build a great place. Let's train them, grow them, nurture them. And you can get humans to put down roots. They do. You know, they're living things. And that's what retention is all about, getting humans to put down roots in your culture and your organization and understand what's in it for them.
And why do you think there are some organizations that still are quite slow to adopt some of these principles, which, as you say, have been talked about in, you know, the research and are quite well evidenced. And there are some, you know, phenomenal companies who've grown very, very quickly where they do put humans at the center of everything they do, where they do teach and drive emotional intelligence across the whole workforce. But why do you think there are some places that are still a little bit slow to adopt this and perhaps don't fully understand the benefits?
I think you have leaders who never had that epiphany or that moment where they said, wow, I get it. I see how powerful this is. If they've never really employed tools on the human side to create a better workplace and witness what happens, then, you know, I guess they're skeptics still. They haven't embraced it. They haven't built those skills and competencies. And I think there is an epiphany moment. You've got to see it happen because it's not visible. It's not like a factory where you could see the person making these incredible parts one after another, and they get together in a room and they put it and out comes this beautiful thing. You know, the fact of the matter is human emotion and all these aptitudes and things are unseen. Those relationships, you can't see them. You know, you can certainly see a bad relationship, but you can't see how great a relationship is in many cases. You can see the people working together, how effectively, you know, that is something that requires some real thinking and insight. So, you know, they've got to trust that the science is right, and they need to dig in, they need to embrace this, and they need to start doing their own research and learning. I went on a learning journey. I got into this, said, I'm going to master this, and actually discovered that this was my passion. You know, your mission finds you in a way based on your passion. I said, wow, I'm very passionate about this. And then ultimately wrote this book, you know, Transforming IT Culture, because I was so passionate about it. And, you know, IT organizations struggle. The leaders get fired. You know, and I've talked to ex-CIOs who said, I wish I'd spent more time on the people side of this organization. You know, they realized late in the game that it didn't come together, they didn't deliver, and they said, had nothing to do with technology. We had all the best technology and everything. It was totally, I couldn't get the people to come together. And it's tragic, you know, when they end up in a situation where they miss this because, you know, management has not made it a priority decade after decade, because many organizations are still living in that industrial ethos where, you know, the infrastructure and the technology and the physical things matter, the labs matter, whatever it is. And they just haven't wrapped their head around the human side is everything. It's it. That's how you win or lose in this era. It's over.
You're listening to the Human Performance Podcast by Verti. If you're enjoying this episode, why not join our newsletter? When you sign up, you'll receive a copy of Level Up straight to your inbox every Thursday with the latest tips, tricks, and news about all things human performance. Head over to verti.com/newsletter to sign up. That's verti.com/newsletter. You can find this in the show notes. Anyway, back to the episode.
And I think as I kind of like alluded to at the top of the conversation, I think if you look across most, you know, IT departments or engineering departments, whether you're in a fast paced startup or a large organization, the types of individuals who go into things like engineering tend to be, you know, on the whole, bit of a generalization, but they tend to be a little bit more kind of introverted. And there is quite a bit of coaching needed to sort of bring out, you know, the best in them and allow them to communicate with other team members, like a product team who might sit in front of customers, and really sort of focus them down around goals and things like that, and bring them together. Do you have any sort of, you know, tips on ways to do that, that anyone listening who might be sort of a CIO themselves or sitting on top of an engineering team can start to consider to sort of implement themselves?
Yeah, well, in fact, I had to do it. I think a lot of it comes down to really creating that environment, that culture, because people don't do what you say, they do what you do. And everybody does, for the most part, want to be included. So you've got to actually demonstrate that inclusiveness. You've got to be inclusive. You've got to create an environment that's inclusive. And these folks will open up. You know, you've got to take the people who are hesitant to speak because they're introverted in a meeting and draw them out, draw them into the meeting. And, you know, make sure people understand how much they have to offer. I found that, you know, trying to educate people on what other people do and how important it is helps in terms of bridging those relationships. People get very focused on what they're doing and they don't really understand the bigger picture and how important what other people are contributing or how hard they're working. And once you can generate that understanding, you know, it starts to open up things. The more empathy appears, they start to be a little more empathetic about what the others are doing. And certainly empathy is a very powerful tool, but compassion is even more powerful because that's really doing something about it. So, yes, you got to model those behaviors. You got to make it imperative. You got to create norms. Say, this is how we work together. You know, we get to know the other person. That's what we do around here. You got to know the whole person. People are more than their job, and encourage everybody to do that. Create those conversations. And as those conversations start to take place, relationships form. As people learn more about others, they find something they have in common, you get a relationship. Sometimes you get great friendships that way. But you got to work on it. You know, you've got to make it an imperative, just like you have imperatives around what has to be delivered, when it has to be done, who's going to do it. You got to do the same thing on the human side. You've got to create those norms for how we work together. You know, very important.
I think it's a fantastic point. And I always go back to my previous career when I was working as a surgeon, and you had people mm-hmm. in your operative team who might come from different backgrounds and might do very different jobs in an operating theatre or in an emergency setting. But one of the key things was really appreciating the elements of the overall teamwork that they provide and looking at how they yep. provide those jobs and also how to get the best out of them as individuals. And I think that's something that, you know, is talked about, but perhaps isn't talked about enough in the setting of certainly IT organizations, but really any team. So exactly as you say, Frank, you know, thinking about, do I really understand what this person does on my team? Do I understand mm-hmm. what makes them tick? How can I, as an individual contributor, get the best out of someone else I'm working with? And skills yeah. like this, where, you know, sometimes that's not, there's no sort of, I guess, off the shelf book really on sort of how to do that for an individual. And it's something that comes with a bit of practice. But, you know, obviously from your background, having been through all these experiences and having written books and given keynote talks and spoken on lots of different platforms, what are some other kind of critical skills do you think that people can work on, either at a, you know, a corporate level as a whole for leaders or at an individual level?
Well, I'd say it all begins with the hiring process. I think many leaders haven't been trained on how to really hire well. And there are an incredible number of different psychometric tests out there. To actually not use them and integrate them into the hiring process, so you know, you should understand kind of what skills and aptitudes are required, and you should be filtering people who don't have those right off the bat. And then you can start to say, wow, you know, here is the type of talent that's really gifted in the areas we need. You know, let's bring them in. Let's find out if they're going to be a cultural fit. I think they should hire in a much more scientific way. I think they should, just like they run networks, and they understand, you know, if the network's up and running, is the infrastructure running well? How well is it running? Oh, no, it's slowing down. Let's all get in there and performance tune it. They need to have constant data about how effectively the human infrastructure is running. I mean, that's why we built a talent operating system, so people can get good insight and feedback into what's happening. And you got to take those same disciplines. You've got to have a process for improving your culture on an ongoing basis. And you've got to work on it and hold people accountable. And you've got to make sure that every leader in your organization can explain how improvements and how people work together is going to drive better business results. Because at the end of the day, it's about turning human capital, people, talent into financial results for the company. Because nobody wins if that doesn't happen, right? You have a company that's not performing. And that's what this is all about. So I think, yes, it's got to be very deliberate. It's got to be intentional. Leaders need to understand that linkage between talent, how well talent and how effectively talent is working to the results, be able to explain it and be an advocate for improving the human capital side so you get better business results and the people and company thrive together. And nothing matters more.
And again, it really links into that piece around data and science and making these things much more data-driven mm-hmm. and evidence-based. And so when you're thinking about 100%. That, you know, that almost kind of, you know, people score and linking to your business goals, what specifically would you look at? Because, you know, there are things like employee NPS scores. You've obviously got your sort of business metrics that you can break down into teams to see who is actually performing, who isn't. But for you personally, what are some of the best metrics that you found to be helpful to improving teams?
Well, you know, what we did is, you know, I discovered along the way that really what everybody is always talking about, or they don't call it that, is there's human emotional needs. Every living thing has a set of needs that have to be met. You know, if you have a plant and you have a garden and you're growing it, it needs a certain type of soil. It needs a certain amount of sunlight, not too much, you know, just what it needs. It needs a certain amount of room, and it's got to be cared for, and you can produce a bumper crop. Well, you know, that is the same thing. There's much more science, like you say, to this. And they've got to get all the data and the metrics and the numbers, and they've got to run this in a very, very human, but a data-informed way. because, you know, it's the human side that you want to grow, nurture, and nourish, and you should understand how well it's operating. If you don't have data at your fingertips on how well your culture's performing, and the bigger the place, the more important this is. One area could be doing well, over here it could be doing terribly. You know, people worry about the Great Resignation. They don't really have their thumb or finger on what's happening. And ultimately, you're managing time, talent, and energy. That's what this comes down to. You know, you want to unlock the mood and the passion. You want to get the right talent in and have it work cohesively together. And you want to fully enable the people so that their time isn't wasted. That's time. You know, where does the time go? You know, you could give people a tremendous amount of things to do. The fact of the matter is humans can work on, you know, three things. And we know from all the cognitive neuroscience, people, you know, they have a certain amount of working memory. You know, they've done these memory experiments, you know, 5 ± 2. And that was how the phone numbers are crafted and created. So they came up with a number string that people could easily remember. You know, here was, you know, three chunks, you know, the area code and the exchange and finally the number. And that's because humans are very good at remembering those three things. But if you give people 12 things to work on, they can't keep it all in memory. So it slows down. It's like a computer where you've tried to get too much done on the machine. It starts slowing down and nothing's getting done. Guess what? That's most companies. Oh, new demand. Take it. Put it in there. Well, it's slowing down because that's the biology. It's not going to work. You got to manage that. You got to keep people focused. People are interrupted so frequently. It's unbelievable. And they know from the studies that 42% of the interruptions are the person's own brain saying, hey, don't forget to do blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when you look at the studies, you can get rid of a lot of those interruptions. A lot of it is because people are preoccupied. Things that they're not getting to because they have too long a list to work on. They don't have work-life balance, so they have a lot of pressing things that they didn't get to in their personal life that are still with them when they're doing their work. Oh, I've got to get to my, you know, elderly parents not doing well. I got to go check in on them, you know, and all day long they'll be thinking about that. And, you know, I put in compressed bye weeks in, you know, every company where I was a CIO, where people could choose if they wanted to work 9 days on and one off, and they could pick the day. Organizations had to make sure that, you know, they didn't have everybody out on one day. But oddly enough, you would think everybody would be on a Monday and a Friday. It wasn't the case. Some people wanted Wednesday off because that was the day, you know, their partner had off and they wanted to be home on that day. And it tended to work out. And I noticed every time I did that in a company, what got done went up tremendously. Because cognitively, you're taking away a set of interruptions that are preventing people from getting in a state of flow to focus on the work. This is all science, and it all works, and it's all fact-based. And, you know, our solution comes with a talent operator's manual because people don't understand this, and they need to understand it, and they can understand, you know, over time, gradually, why all this stuff really matters. And they need to know. That's it. It's no more. It's no longer an option. It's over.
It's a really interesting and very practical, you know, option that you've just given there. And I was just sort of reflecting as you were talking. I think, you know, certainly when I worked in healthcare, and even to a degree now, often I do quite a lot of work, perhaps too much, over, you know, a weekend day, because I don't have the distractions of things like meetings or people sort of pinging me on Slack or some asynchronous communication tools. And it means basically I can actually have a focused period of time where I can get the stuff done that is really, you know, has been bugging me to finish. And that's a really great practical suggestion where you're actually offering that up to employees, where if they are getting stuff done, they can then pick, you know, when they have some time off. I think that's a really nice way of doing things.
Yeah, it's perfect. And every company should do this. You know, even though people are working remote or they're in a hybrid world of work, it's about the workload. It's about freeing them up to focus on things that are distracting them. Many people are preoccupied in the office. That means you've got this talent, your piece of equipment that's operating suboptimally. It's just not optimized to produce for you. And, you know, if that were a network slowing down or a computer slowing down, things were not working, everybody jump on it. What is this? You know, everything's slow today. But the people side, oh, it doesn't matter. They have no idea. You know, it's the unseen. That's why you got to follow practices that produce great results, because you're not going to see the inside of the brain. You don't have any of these, you know, functional neuroscience things where you can monitor what's happening in the brain. But it is going on, and it is, they are slowing down. They're getting congested. People give them too much to do. They overload their memory. They, you know, they're preoccupied, so they're interrupted all the time. And then they interrupt them in addition to the all the 42% the person's doing on their own. They make sure there's another load of it in the office with constant instant messages, you know, calls, meetings all day long, meetings where they shouldn't even be spending time. The amount of time people waste in meetings that's unproductive is just mind-blowing.
Amen to that. I absolutely despise meetings that don't have any kind of like meeting agenda. And in fact, yeah, in my companies, I've basically banned any meetings that don't have an agenda, and anything that goes over 30 minutes really has to be sort of really, really important. And I often say, you know, to people that work in any of my organizations, that if they're in a meeting and they're not being brought in, they're not contributing, or they're finding it's not helping them, they should just proactively leave and get on with what they need to do. Because
that's right.
Again, it's that thing where you've only got so many hours in your day. And if you're being asked to come into a meeting and you're not contributing and it's not contributing to you, that's wasted time, basically.
Oh, you're right, Alex. And, you know, it's the old Racy, right? Responsible, accountable, consulted, informed. You know, got a bunch of people in the meeting only need to be informed. They don't need to sit there for 2 hours to get informed. Somebody could summarize what happened at the meeting. They're copied on the minutes. That's why minutes matter. Now they got all the benefits of the meeting and they have to spend 2 hours to get it. This is what should happen. And when you look at the cost of getting everybody there and not having one person work on kind of concise minutes, not a book, you know, hey, these are the 8 things we decided to do. Boom. If anybody thinks we missed something, let us know. Yeah, that makes sense. People don't want to read 2 pages of minutes. They want to know what are the most important things that happened. So, you know, none of it's built around human performance. And that's the fundamental problem. And that's the blind spot. And until companies say, we are going to use talent in the most educated way possible, right? We're going to leverage the science. We're going to create an environment where people give their best. And that should be the CEO getting up in front of it saying, you know what? Listen, we have not been able to master the human side and create an environment where everybody is both motivated and able to give their best. I want all of us to come together. I want to create the best company in the world. We want feedback on what's not working. We're going to train the leaders and individuals in this place on why this stuff matters. And I want everybody to come together. I'm going to report back to everybody. We're going to reward people who are doing it the best. And that's a mission everybody can get on board with. And that's a winning mission. Because now people are motivated. They're growing. They're learning the human side of business. That's growth. What do millennials want more than anything right now? They want to grow. That's an area of growth they need to be successful in their own lives and for the company to be successful in their work life. So this matters, and it should be that big in every company. The CEO should be saying, we're going to master this. We're going to get in the tools. We're going to monitor this. Everybody's going to be able to link how well their people are performing, what's holding them back to the what they're generating and producing, and they're going to be able to methodically and knowledgeably improve that. And that's a great mission. And everybody would be on board with no problem because it makes work better. It's not about squeezing juice from a lemon. That's what they're trying to do today with these environments that don't work, right? They shove more on top of it. They're trying to squeeze juice from a lemon. When it's really optimized and the friction's removed and people are in a state of flow, they're getting much more work done with much less stress. The company's prospering. And, you know, we did a study with Rutgers Business School of their alumni. And, you know, we put the performance of the companies as reported by the people in this survey into 4 quartiles. you know, top performing. We did our best to go get financial information where we could to say, yeah, this is accurate. And, you know, the companies that were performing the best in the fourth quartile, they were getting these human factors of leadership right. There was much more caring, empathy, and compassion. People's achievement needs were being met. There was a lot more vulnerability there. The mood and the vibe were really good in those places. The open-ended comments that we got back were very positive. You know, you would say, hey, this is an incredible place to work, innovative. We asked for a few words to describe it. You know, the lowest ones on the lowest quartile, I remember reading it. You know, we're talking about one. These are toxic work environments. You get comments like pure misery. Literally, that's one of the comments from somebody who said, this is a horrible place to work. But although they were hitting on all cylinders, they got think time right. Made sure people had time to think, to sit back, think, and make other contributions based on that thinking. So they were more innovative. People contributed more time to fixing and improving things, making work better. And as they did that, wow, this virtuous cycle kicks off. Because now things are improving more. They get more think time. They get more time to innovate. And it was interesting that that variable, think time, without a doubt, was one of the defining human factors that said, these are really the top performers. Because the places that are at level three, they're not as finely optimized, and there really isn't much think time. So their numbers were far below. So it was a great proof of the whole thing, that that data was valid. We found, you know, and we assessed essentially our model of these human factors and needs that drive performance. And it all came together. And that's a real thing. And we can benchmark companies against that and say, hey, here's how you're doing. This is what you got to work on. But I'll tell you, very few companies really do have think time for their people. They have the opposite.
That's really, really interesting. And I think, as you say, that was sort of the word on the tip of my tongue, which is benchmarking and allowing, you know, companies who perhaps don't have insight into anything out there outside of their own organization to really see how others are doing things and how it can work very well for them if they do implement some of these, you know, human-centric processes and optimize their culture around their people. I think that's a fantastic example, actually. But Frank, just as we sort of, you know, start to wind things up, I mean, obviously you've got a wealth of experience. And one of the things I always enjoy asking people is who's kind of influenced you in your journey and who your human performance hero is. So I'd be really, really interested to know who's kind of had an impact on you as an individual going through all of your own experiences and starting your own businesses.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I had this epiphany in 1997. And I said, wow, the human side is everything. So I went out and bought Daniel Goleman's book on emotional intelligence and opened a world up to me. But I started researching. I said, there've got to be companies out there that get this, who really do it right. And, you know, I was a tech guy and SAS out of Cary, North Carolina, was perennially winning the Best Place to Work award. And so, you know, I discovered this company really does it right. And Jim Goodnight, one of the co-founders, you know, he said, you know, the most important assets in the company drive out of here every night. It's my business to make sure they drive back in the morning, something like that. And, you know, he was always a hero to me. I said, this guy gets it totally. He has built a great company. They had like 40 years of uninterrupted revenue growth. Privately owned, not driven by the whims of the stock market and some quarterly number. You know, when the 2008 downturn hit, you know, I always kept an eye on them. They eventually went on to win not just the best place to work, but the best multinational place to work. You know, it was like a global award. A phenomenal company. And I remember in that 2008 crisis, maybe it was around 2010, I was reading about them. And where most companies had decided what they should do is really cut expenses and lay a bunch of people off, Jim Goodnight said, look, what we're going to do is we're not going to lay anybody off. We're going to focus on winning business. And they went on to have some of their best years ever. While most people were going down and collapsing, they had one of their best years ever. And one of his quotes back then was, you know, I immediately took all this worry out of the whole workforce so they could focus on, you know, us being great again. And this is that preoccupation, right? If people are sitting there, you know how many companies make this mistake? They let the rumor mill, that water cooler talk, you know, get out of control about numbers aren't looking good. There's going to be a layoff. What do people become preoccupied with? Survival. They start talking about it all the time. They think about it. They start thinking about maybe I should be looking to go somewhere else. So now their mind is completely on their survival and their future, not on the work. And there's something called strategic trust, which is, you know, it's a very human thing. It's, do you trust in the leaders of the company to get me to a good place in the future? Humans were always hunter-gatherers. They were traveling. You know, this is embedded. Humans are wired with all this stuff. And strategic trust says, you know what? I'll have a good future here. I can relax. And that's what Jim Goodnight did. He created that strategic trust again, as he had done time over time, year after year. This guy got the human side so deeply. He was always a hero of mine. You know, I never did interview him, but at the end of the day, he really got it right. He's brilliant. He got the human side better than anybody. And he's one of these people who has that innate high EQ. He just gets it, you know, and there's these companies, they never studied the human side, or maybe they did, but some of them just intuitive about it. They get it and they do it in just a big way, and their results speak for themselves.
That's awesome. What a great example. And I think, you know, in any company, whenever there's sort of a, you know, an economic downturn or anything external that affects them, often it's, you know, the companies who have people and a strong culture who actually do well out of that, because everyone rallies around, they don't panic, and actually they attack some of those niches where they can actually have impact and drive revenues, as they said. So I think that's a fantastic example.
I was just going to say, they finally hit a spot where they did have some flat revenue in the last few years because of COVID and all this other stuff, but they don't lay people off. They're an amazing company. You know, they've always run fantastically. So I think there's something that most companies could aspire to, and you don't have to know the science. All you got to do is look at what these companies have accomplished with talent. And you, as a CEO of a company, should say, I can aspire to that and be that, because you can be that. You can always be human in a very productive, effective way.
No, absolutely. I think it's fantastic advice. And Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. And if anyone does want to find out a little bit more about what you do, your background, your books, where can they go to do so?
They could go to, www.peopleproductiveoneword.com. We're People Productive. They can go there. They can find me on LinkedIn. If you're watching this and you want to connect, just say, hey, you know, I was watching the Human Performance Podcast. Really, I have a couple of questions for you. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can email me. My email's, you know, right there. Happy to talk to anybody. You know, we'd love to help you build a workplace where the people and company thrive together. That's what we do. And, you know, we love it. It's fun.
Fantastic. Well, it's absolutely fun. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I think, I'm just going to sort of second to everyone listening that you've also got a lot of content that you sort of put yourself out on LinkedIn Live and some other places. And it's definitely worth connecting with you and following along, especially if you're new into a role or you're just looking to optimize some of the human performance or people at your organization at the moment. Really, really good resources. And it's been just great speaking with you, and look forward to all of the things you're going to do next and all the other companies you're going to help.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much, buddy. Really appreciate you having me on here. It's a great podcast. I love Human Performance. You nailed it.